You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My podcast today is with Mike Thomas, who is the author of two critically acclaimed books, The Second City Unscripted, Revolution and Revelation at the World Famous Comedy Theater. I know that book. And you might remember me, The Life and Times of Phil Hartman. Great biography of Phil. He spent more than 14 years as an arts and entertainment features writer at the Chicago Sun-Times and as a regular contributor to Chicago Magazine. His latest book is a collaboration of sorts with the late Bill Zamy. It's called Carson the Magnificent. So Bill Zamy, legendary writer, celebrity biographer, magazine writer, actually worked with Second City on an ill-fated television program. And Bill had been working, he had access to Carson and been working on this book, and it was his white whale. He never finished it. So Mike came in and finished it, and it's being published, and I think you'll enjoy our conversation.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time.
Mike Thomas, welcome to the podcast.
That's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start this conversation by telling the audience who our friend Bill Zamy was.
Bill Zamy was a master celebrity profiler who died last year, a good friend of mine for almost three decades. He was with Rolling Stone. He was with Esquire. He wrote a few books on Frank Sinatra and Andy Kaufman and Regis Philbin, most of which I helped him with. So he was my kind of journalistic hero there for a while, as well as a mentor early on. And here I am coming full circle, finishing his last book.
And a real Chicago icon. I was remembering my last lunch with him, and we were at a restaurant down the street. I think we were at Topo Gigio down the street, and it just... everyone stopped by the table. It was like, there's Dan Filato, who was the producer for Stephen Gary and the Cubs and all that. Man Cow, the radio personality, yeah, stopped by the table. It was just like, yeah, everyone knew Bill. Super nice guy. He had a particular gift that elevated the form. This wasn't like a Kitty Kelly, you know, biographer.
It was not. No, yeah. Bill did not leave bodies in his wake, as he used to say. You know, he could be cutting, but it was always in a very creative way. I don't think many subjects hated what he wrote. I mean, in fact, most of them ended up loving what he wrote, as evinced by, Sharon Stone was gushing over him last year in obituaries when he died. David Copperfield didn't much care for what he wrote. I remember that back in the day.
But David Copperfield is a problematic figure, to say the least.
It was tough. I mean, and I think I remember him saying Arnold Schwarzenegger felt that he was asking silly questions like, could you bench press Sylvester Stallone? And Arnold would say, you shame your magazine with those questions.
he just
loved being playful. He was a very playful guy when it came to language.
But this book, this Carson book, that this was his monster in a box.
It was. I mean, Carson's, you know, was his white whale for a long while. He finally landed him, did a big profile for Esquire in 2002. And shortly after Carson died in 2005, Bill landed the contract to do this book, and he toiled on it for many years through both personal and creative difficulties, and just was never able to get it finished. And by the time 2013 came around and he was diagnosed with cancer, after that, he was just in no shape to go on energy-wise or anything else. So it was on the shelf for 10 years after he died.
So did you have qualms at all about taking on this project, or was it something Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, the qualms I had were Bill was a giant in his field, Johnny was a giant in his field, and who am I to step in and take over where Bill left off and write about Johnny? I mean, you know, I liked Johnny. I was not the fanboy Bill was from back in the day. Bill was an intense Johnny fan, knew everything there was to know about him. Plus, he knew Johnny personally. He had gotten on the inside with a lot of Johnny's intimates, gained their trust. And so, sure, at the outset, you feel like kind of an interloper. But at the same time, we all wanted this book to get done, and this was the only way it was going to happen. So I'm happy his editor and now the CEO of Simon & Schuster, John Karp, asked me to do it. But I did take a while initially to see what Bill had culled in terms of research and reporting. I had no idea what he had. And his daughter gave me the key to this big storage locker on the north side. And there were just stacks upon stacks and crates. And I ended up going through it, determining there was plenty of material, and then spending months rifling through that before I could even start writing.
So we should level set about Carson, because people in our age group, like, even if you weren't a fanboy, he was ubiquitous. I mean, it was the day during the week, at least, was set at the end with him. Literally, there was no one bigger for three decades. I guess I get the sort of. And the white whale part of it is a very, in many ways, a very complicated figure. And that's what this book is weaving through.
It is. I mean, Bill initially, I think, thought he could approach this as, I had worked on a Frank Sinatra book with him back in the day, like 97. And that was a very kind of easy breezy Frank's guide to life for dudes. And, you know, Frank wore his emotions on his sleeve and everything was overt with him. I think Bill initially thought Johnny might benefit from the same treatment, but Johnny was such an inner guy. You saw dribs and drabs of him come out on the show, but he was a hard guy to know. And that made writing about him all that much tougher. With the profile, Bill was focusing on one thing. It was his retirement. This was Johnny in repose. And so there was kind of that unifying theme. But with the book, this is a birth to earth thing. Yeah. And it's Johnny did not wear his heart on his sleeve like Frank. And so it became all that much tougher.
There's some incredible prose in this book. Here's one passage, quote, "Inside the box where it was dark and warm, where he was bright and cool, he came a man called Johnny, and was not ever John. There he had risen and reigned as iconic king and cultural potentate, a smooth midnight sentinel possessed of Herculean fortitude and winking glimmer and other ineffable qualities mastered solely to resonate behind a glass picture screen, especially when it was very late," end quote.
I love it. That is Bill. That is Bill, right? Zamy right there.
So
the essence of, not a wasted word. I mean, and I'm sure he thought and thought about how that, you know, writing was very rhythmic for him too, as you might imagine. The best writing is musical, as you well know. So yeah, that was great.
And the themes that run through this book, like, I don't know that it answers the question in terms of Johnny. Here's one of the things I thought. Irvin Goffman was a social psychologist, and I came across a paper of his that's from 1958, 59, right around when Second City started, actually. And Goffman suggests, and he uses, you'll see why I like this, that ourselves are many things. He goes, we have our onstage self, we have our offstage self, and we have our backstage self. They're all different.
Sure.
And necessarily so, because I think one of the misnomers of our culture is this idea of, like, you're one thing, you got to be consistent, you can't change your mind. And Johnny was nothing if not many things all at once.
Yeah, he definitely was. I mean, Johnny could be very playful and witty on stage, and he could be sour and cruel behind the scenes. I mean, he was not unlike a lot of performers. I think there was a lot of inner turmoil there that he dealt with, but you never saw it in front of the camera. He was a cool cucumber in a cool medium. He was just perfect for the medium of television, and that's part of the reason he was able to reinvent that. You know, I mean, Johnny on TV, it's like he was born for the job.
Yeah, yeah. So if people don't know, essentially the Modern Tonight Show basically started with Steve Allen, who was very successful. There was a thing before, but really that's the Tonight Show. And then Jack Parr. And Jack Parr, they're very different.
Extremely.
And Jack Parr, very funny. I don't know that young people will remember him. But talk a bit about the difference between those two.
Well, Parr was a much more emotional guy, and he wasn't afraid to show those emotions on camera. I mean, in fact, Carson used to joke about that. I mean, Parr would cry on camera if something moved him, or he would get angry on camera. You know, Carson always maintained an equilibrium. He was unflappable. So yeah, they were very different, different interviewers. Carson was a much more sort of off the cuff, playful, improvisational interviewer.
Yeah.
I mean, they might have had, you know, pre-screening. I don't know how much of that they did way back in the day, but it was always like it was happening in the moment. Nothing was sort of pre-planned. And he was a curious guy, and you could tell mm-hmm. that by the tenor and type of his questions. So, I think the reason Parr probably won't be remembered like Johnny is because Johnny reinvented the medium, and Johnny sort of bled into everybody else. Johnny influenced Letterman, who influenced Fallon and Kimmel, who influenced. So there's always a vestige of Johnny in all of these guys going forward, even if it's not in the front of people's brains that, oh yeah, that's Johnny Carson. So I think in that way, he's kind of immortal.
I think Parr probably thought of himself as a public intellectual a little bit.
He did.
And though Carson was not stupid by any stretch, that was not where he. The other thing about Carson, of course, is the Jack Benny influence, which, you know, using listening, using space, beats, pauses. I mean, the Benny look, Carson just did that.
That was his hero.
That.
Yeah.
Was.
Or one of.
Yeah, no, he was the big one though,
yeah.
And you can see it that level of listening to the end of every sentence was the superpower that Johnny had that made it not just it wasn't an interview, it was a conversation.
It was a conversation.
It had to be in front of all these people.
Yeah,
the in the book, I guess Bill did this. He said, "quote In my dispatch, I reported he had kept two articles at his feet behind his desks all those years: a rubber chicken, symbolizing comedy, and a wooden arrow left over from a bad Custer sketch, symbolizing failure."
Isn't that great?
Seriously? That's a real thing?
Yeah, that's a real thing, you know?
So let's talk about the failure part of it. Like, so I mean, I know this, right? But you know, how Carson was able to, we call it failure, but what Carson did was always turn it into comedy.
It was artistic failure in a way.
Yes.
And his writers, and I mean, I even reached out back out to a couple of them for further illumination. And one of them in particular, Mike Berry, said, well, of course, bombing was never the aim.
No.
But it became this thing that people kind of hoped for because Carson could turn it into something funny with just a look or a sigh or a whatever it was. It was almost something that was built into the show. Mm-hmm. You know, you knew even if he fizzled with his material, it was probably going to be funny. And that was ever present.
Yeah. 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 I didn't realize how important Red Skelton was to promoting a young Johnny Carson. And this doesn't show up in the book, but I'm married to a comedy professor, as you know. Red Skelton, mm-hmm. notoriously terrible to his writers.
I don't know if I'd heard he was terrible to his writers, but he was great to Carson.
Great to Carson? Yeah. Oh, no. He used to tear up. He would literally tear up the scripts that they would give him, reassemble the jokes in different order and tape them out and then use that, and among other tirades.
Interesting. Well, Carson didn't get that for sure, because Red loved him, and he would tell people he loved him, like, this kid's
right.
got something, back early on when he was Johnny was doing Carson's Cellar and Carson's Coffee Break and these sort of short-lived local shows that he did. Red Skelton discovered him and said, "Well, you know, I think he's going to go somewhere."
This was an interesting facet of the personality. From the book, quote, "You could tell that he had a sense of personal dignity, even though he was willing to surrender it. So many people, especially in comedy today, are very afraid of surrendering their dignity. Well, who is more respected than Johnny Carson?" End quote.
I know. I reread that the other day, and it was like a revelation.
let's talk about that, because I think this is as much about Carson and comedy as it is about how we conduct ourselves in this human thing that we do.
I think it is too. I mean, Carson wasn't willing to be, I shouldn't say this. He was the buffoon sometimes, but it was all about the funny. It was all in service of the funny. You know,
it was never cool.
He was never not cool. No, it wasn't, but it was almost like this guy who obviously nobody's going to accuse Carson of not having an ego, but it's the ego took a back seat to the funny, and all the best performers are like that. They're willing to subject themselves to certain circumstances, are willing to look a certain way. Looking cool is, as you know, I don't have to tell you, this is the antithesis of comedy. But that's Johnny could both look cool and be funny somehow. And that's hard to do.
I think that's, maybe because it's not really surrendering your dignity, it's surrendering to the moment.
To the moment.
Because the dignity is, if you know it's there, it's always there, and you can play in the moment. And so, I and I'm curious in terms of, I don't know how much of the book was in order or the themes, but there's a really lovely blend of themes that come through. One is, you know, married four times, issues with his mom, clearly that sort of like, and then his love of magic. And the sort of illusion aspects. Did Bill already find those themes, or those things that you highlighted when you started in on the book?
No, Bill had mined all of those. I mean, Bill had 3/4 of this book written, and it was very polished by the time I got to read it, because that's part of what I had to do before I started this is read his manuscript as well as see the reporting he had done, and all of that magic stuff was in there. It's solid. We didn't change any of it. So Bill, he had talked to him about that, but he had also sort of made his own conclusions based on what Johnny had said in other interviews and just sort of, the parallel between what magicians do and what Johnny did. It was kind of Johnny was an illusion. Johnny on stage was an illusion. That wasn't, it was part of him, but that wasn't the full guy. And so he was always masking something up there.
Yeah.
Whatever it was.
There are 2 quotes from Ed McMahon in the book. One was, he was great with 10 million, not great with 10. 10 got a little
exactly.
pressed for him. And the other is that he packed a tight suitcase.
He did. That's the famous quote. I mean, psychologically speaking, I think that's the same with a lot of performers, though, right? They're great in front of 10,000 and you give them a room of 10 people and they're extremely uncomfortable. You can explain that psychology better than I can, being having been around performers.
Yeah.
For many decades.
No one gets into this work because they're well adjusted. I think that's generally true of most of us. It's just that this gig requires you then to be on a stage, so you're going to face a different kind of scrutiny. And I think there's 2 things. One, you can never escape from where you grew up. And so this, he's a middle child. His parents withhold affection, apparently. I mean, it is a staggering moment in the book when he discovers that after his mom died that she saved like basically all his press clippings.
Yeah, she was very stingy with praise. Even when he was at the height of his powers, she couldn't quite bring herself to compliment him or say, "Johnny, hey mom, I got this award. Yeah, I guess that's okay." And then he discovers this scrapbook she had kept. All of her friends, especially early on, had sent her clippings of Johnny on the rise, and they'd annotated them with little notes, and they were all in a book. I think they were found in the back of a closet somewhere, if I'm recalling that correctly. But, that must have been a revelation to him when that was.
Do you believe the Burt Reynolds quote? Because Burt Reynolds in his memoir said that upon hearing of his mom's death, that Johnny said the Wicked Witch is dead.
I think it's not, it's feasible.
It's feasible.
It's feasible. I think so. Yeah. I who knows if it's absolutely true, but it seems in the spirit of other things Johnny had said about his mom. The mommy issues lingered for his whole life.
Yeah. I didn't know the story about him in the Navy. Was he forthcoming about that, or was that?
Not really. Not really. There was a little bit. There's some in articles early on. And, Johnny talked about it once or twice. His mother recounted what he had written them in a letter about, an explosion going off on the ship and him having to go below decks and recover bodies. And it was just a really gruesome scene. But I think like a lot of those guys, he never talked about it.
No, that's part of the problem, right?
Yeah, it's part of the problem. I mean, who knows how that played into his later psychology, but yeah, that couldn't have been something that was easy to keep bottled up.
It is kind of interesting that the game show before The Tonight Show was called Who Do You Trust, given a guy who had real kind of trust issues. Maybe the wrong people a lot.
Yeah, he did. He had trust issues, and then later in his career, he trusted people who screwed him over. So, I never thought about the connection between Who Do You Trust and that, but that is pretty interesting. Yeah. I think when you get to certain heights, inevitably people come out and want a piece of you. And, he tried to keep as many of those people at bay as possible, but some of them got through. Not an uncommon story.
No, not an uncommon story. I did not. So I knew that Paul Anka wrote Johnny's theme, the opening song for The Tonight Show. I did not know that Carson made him split the royalties.
Yeah, apparently 50-50. I mean, but Anka never complains about it. Anka's like, well, God, I think it was making Anka $1 million a year, some crazy money.
They split a couple $1 million a year for like 30 years.
At one point, for doing nothing. So Anka was like, yeah, I was a young up-and-coming songwriter. What do I care? Yeah.
Did you talk to Doc? He's still alive, right?
Bill talked to Doc. No, I did not talk to Doc. I did not have to reach out to many of the people that Bill had talked to because he had so much reporting done, including a whole binder full of Doc stuff.
There's a couple emails
from the kids. Yeah, again to Bill, Corey Carson, one of his sons, finally chimed in and illuminated, the father-son relationship, which I was glad to see. But Johnny always admitted he was not the best father. He wasn't there. The Tonight Show was his primary love and responsibility. And, he was forthcoming about that. He was disappointed, I think, in himself for not having been a better father. And you could tell that there was a genuine love for his sons, especially when his son Ricky died. He went into deep mourning and was affected for the rest of his life. And you wonder how much of that is because he hadn't formed this solid father-son relationship that he thought he should have.
I'm sure. And I think also the fact that he was the middle child and then his middle child died and that he was probably the most like him.
He was the most like him. In fact, that's what people said humor, personality. So it was a reflection of himself as well. You're right.
I did not know that he was offered the role in Scorsese's King of Comedy that eventually went to Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, and he turned it down. Apparently, De Niro came to his house to try to convince him. And
if he just played himself, he would have been perfect.
I think so. I can't think of it at this point without Jerry Lewis, but
Jerry Lewis was great in that role.
Yeah,
there's no question. But Jerry Lewis can't withhold.
No, he can't. You're right. Carson would have played a whole different character. The character would have been transformed, and you wonder how the movie would have been transformed as a result of his performance, because he is not Jerry Lewis.
No, and this again, one of the threads that runs through the book is this idea of omission. Right. And so there's the omission in terms of Carson comedically He's like the Hemingway was to prose. He is to comedy, which is he just pulls it back. The omission of not being home, you know, with the kids and the marriages failing and all these sort of omissions. And then he had like there were death threats like that, like pretty serious stuff that tailed him almost his entire time on the show. Right.
Yeah, and you wonder how those affected him. I mean, you have to internalize some of that when that much venom is coming your way. But, you know, he kept most of that under wraps. There was a very public scene where Carson was part of this ransom drop-off in the early 70s. You know, they found like a fake grenade and a note on his front porch, and he worked with the, you know, the cops to in this sting operation. But mostly they would just roll into the office as it became more and more famous, and they were just crazy. I have this whole binder of FBI files of all these crazy handwritten notes, you know, that, as I think I said in the book, most of them murdered syntax. They were all over the place. And, you know, saying, I need this much money or I'm coming to kill you, or, you know, even threatening Ed McMahon, you better watch out. And I think that just became common. He had mostly other people deal with that. I don't know how much of it he saw personally because other people would open the mail. Mm-hmm. But certainly he must have seen some of it. So, yeah, again, that's another thing to absorb and impact you. You don't know how that's going to come out in life. I always said that about Royko, too. Royko got a ton of hate mail. And he used to be playful about it. Like, yeah, give me venom. Like, you know, give me hate. But it comes out in different ways. So maybe that was the case with Carson as well.
Yeah, I can't imagine that ultimately any of us are so strong as to not allow those sorts of messages impact us negatively. It's like you could put a facade on it, but I mean, yeah, I've gotten that stuff here when I was in a leadership position, not infrequently. Wow. And it sucked. And it was like, and at a certain point, cops had to get called because this stuff got a little weird. And that was, and I even recounting it to you, I'm like, oh God, I remember that. And like, I'm so glad I'm not in that. And then because of the other thing I was going to say is Carson didn't attend either of his parents' funerals and he didn't attend his kid's funeral.
Yeah. Didn't like funerals. It's something about being reminded of mortality, of maybe getting emotional. I mean, there's he never said anything specific that I could find about why he didn't, but he even told his brother, his brother would tell him, John, you probably won't go to your own funeral. And Carson's like, I ain't going.
I think, you know, look, as you get older, and I wonder if Carson, and because Carson is like the only celebrity who retired who actually retired. I can't think of another one.
Fully retired. He was going to come back there for a minute, but then he just decided, I've left it all on the floor. I don't need to prove anything else. And I thought it was admirable, you know?
That never happens.
No, just he made a clean break. He came back and did a couple of shows, made a couple of appearances. But other than that, man, he was on the boat. He was at restaurants playing tennis, playing poker with Steve Martin and Carl Reiner. I mean, he was a fully retired guy and by all accounts loving it. So
I met him shortly before he retired. He did a benefit here in Chicago that my dad was emceeing.
And oh, wow.
So, yeah. So I went backstage. And he was very charming and very funny. But I remember driving home, and I was probably 10 or 11 at the time. And he made a joke about the jokes going over my head, which they did, some of them did. But I remember saying to my dad, I go, God, there's something kind of sad about that guy.
And my dad's really? Like, even at 11 years old, you picked up
on
that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was just something like, again, the withholding, like you could... And especially, you know, being with someone like my dad, who is kind of the opposite of that, you know, also someone in the public eye, but also someone who is genuinely the person he was on stage was same off stage, really warm.
Sure.
Connecting. And I did not that energy was not. And again, I was kind of expecting it because I was probably at that point in front of the biggest superstar I'd ever been in front of.
Yeah, I bet. Because, well, all you'd seen at that point was on TV. You'd seen Johnny's energy and his electricity on the small screen. It's often a dichotomy, you know, with performers. Yeah. Again, as you well know, you see him backstage or on the street and they are not who they are.
No, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
So he was it emphysema that he got?
Yeah. Yeah, it was emphysema. He smoked a lot for a long time, tried to quit off and on, but he would always bemoan these damn cigarettes. And, you know, I remember there's one scene in there where I think Doc Severinsen and some others are out on Johnny's first yacht, and Johnny dives in the water, and Doc sees him gasping for air and thinks in retrospect, maybe that's the first time something was really, really going wrong. And yeah, I mean, as of, I think, you know, after 2002, he kind of went downhill. So Bill, when Bill interviewed him, it was January, I think, of 2001. The profile in Esquire came out in 2002. Johnny died in 2005. So he didn't have that many good years ahead of him after Bill met with him. But he was in pretty good health when they met up.
Was he? I can't recall in the book. I think it is mentioned, but was he already starting to lose the voice, though, then?
He was. His voice was a little cottony and higher, and he was definitely an older guy. His face was fuller, but, you know, he still had the ramrod, you know, sort of stance and posture, and he was still Johnny in a lot of ways, just Johnny retired, older Johnny, not the Johnny we all remembered from nightly monologues. And I think for Bill, that was a bit jarring at first, but Bill had also seen him gradually over the years. Like, even before Bill sat down with him in 2001, Bill had just he'd been popping by Johnny's offices in Santa Monica and getting to know Johnny's office staff, his executive assistant, and other people. And once in a while, Carson would come by and, you know, they'd shoot the breeze in the hall, but they had never had a proper sit down until then. So Bill got to see a bit of Johnny before that in the 90s after he retired.
So you've written books. I've written a book, but this is different, right? So it's Bill's book, which is, I mean, but you had this job. How'd you know you were done?
I mean, how do you ever know you're done?
This is what I'm wondering, because it's like, it's hard for our stuff. But I was like, how do I know I'm done with Bill's book?
Well, first of all, they didn't want, a mammoth finish.
Yeah.
To the book. So I had that kind of restraining me. I mean, I wrote longer than even the editors wanted, and they were fine with that. But I just think I wanted to hit all of the major beats in different ways. Some of the stuff gets short shrift because it's been so highly publicized before, like the Joan Rivers.
That was the one I was surprised wasn't in there.
A few. Yeah. I mean, it's in there, but it's
little.
Yeah, it's been reported so much. I wanted to concentrate on a lot of stuff that Bill had original reporting for.
Yeah.
And there was some of that, but it rehashed all the same old material. The stuff about his son, for instance, with the death of his son, that was a lot of new material that I thought was very revelatory about Johnny. So things like that, I expanded. And yeah, it was, I had to make calls all the way through, but I kept it chronological. As you probably see, Bill flashes forward a little bit in the early book. So it was also a balancing act of, if I'm going to broach something that he's already broached in his part of the book, it either has to be a knowing broaching of that subject, or it has to be fully expanded if that subject was only glanced upon early on in the book. So there was a lot of... there was a lot of that type of balance going on, but I basically just took Johnny from New York to LA through the end of his life until they scattered his ashes at sea.
Yeah. One thing I thought about the Joan Rivers thing was it fit in the issues that he had in his entire life with women, because he'd been, it's not like he hadn't been betrayed by men, but I think the fact that a woman betrayed him made that, the venom extra, because he never forgave her.
No, he never forgave her, but he never said why. I mean, of course, that may be the psychology behind it.
That's right.
But you're not going to get Johnny on a couch saying, this is why I will never forgive Joan Rivers. I mean, that would be awesome, but not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
And it didn't happen. So,
Before I ask you for a yes and story, was there a big surprise in terms of when you started going through the material, either in anecdotes that you sort of didn't realize, or Bill's approach, or where he was at actually? Because the fact that the book was kind of like, if you're saying it's 3/4 done, I think you said that, right?
It was three-fourths done lengthwise, but he really hadn't gotten Johnny out of New York yet, except for the flesh.
Oh, he hadn't gotten Johnny out of New York.
No. There was, except for those little parts where he would go into Johnny's later life. But no, Johnny was still in New York. So, I had to take him basically from 1972 on. And it's a big life,
No,
that's a lot to include.
It also makes me feel like that feels to me like the easier part to write about. It was fresher. Bill had firsthand experience with all that period.
Yes, exactly. Because before, there were some people around that knew Johnny from probably the 60s. Not the 50s, though.
No.
That stuff is hard to sort of mine, and it, came from a lot of other material that Bill had. But yeah, the stuff from the 60s on was most of the original reporting.
Yeah, so any surprises for you?
Surprises about Johnny in particular.
Yeah.
I was surprised. I only knew Johnny as a performer, but I was surprised at the guy's humanity. Hmm. Honestly, he didn't wear his emotions on his sleeve like Sinatra did, but Johnny could be very emotional toward people he loved. He was very generous with his charities. I mean, he left $156 million from his trust to his charitable foundation at the end. And a lot of it was done quietly. It wasn't this, Sackler, look at me, trying to cover something up bullshit. So he was a generous guy as well. I mean, the dark and the light existed within him, but I was surprised to learn more about Johnny as this well-rounded man rather than just a performer.
Yeah. I didn't realize after his last show that he had the entire staff, a couple hundred people, over to his home for this party and dinner, except no NBC execs.
No execs. Right, which was great.
Suits are not allowed.
This major blowout at his place, inside and out, and that had to be probably not the most comfortable situation for Johnny. That was his fortress of solitude, that big Malibu estate that he had up on the bluff there, and he allowed everybody into his inner sanctum at least for a night. It didn't happen again that I know of.
All right, Mike. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
A point where I said yes and.
The idea essentially is like, most of us in our life, we're easy with our no's. And so the idea is there a point in your life where you normally would have said no, but instead you said yes and?
I think just writing this book, I wasn't.
My thought.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a hard no right away, but I wasn't sure. And I said to myself, especially after looking at all the material, I've got to take this chance, even though Bill was who he was and Johnny was who he was. And, this was not my book. So it was different coming into it than it had been my previous two. I'm glad I took the chance, and I'm glad I took it because it's a great full circle moment for me. I mean, Bill was a mentor from early on. I came to him as a 20-something wannabe Bill Zamy writer, having read all of his stuff, and he was kind enough to meet up with me and let me pick his brain. And it just so happened he needed a research assistant, and so many things sprung out of that. He introduced me to people, to editors, to celebrities, he brought me into his inner circle and opened doors, and we became really good friends for about three decades. So I'm glad I said yes to this endeavor.
I'm glad you did too. It's a really great book. It's called Carson the Magnificent. Mike Thomas, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Great being here.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.